Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Going to be reading from the last verse of a very fascinating chapter, The Movements of the Living Entities. This is Kapila Dev speaking to Devahuti, chapter 31. If you have your little device, you can pull it out. 331:48. It's the last verse. So the last two verses are what I call the therefore verses, you know, the summary verses that Prabhupada is wrapping up. Kapila Dev also wrapping up a summary of really long explanation, so kind of like the bird's eye view, the big picture. Is as follows. The message that's found in Prabhupada makes reference to the first canto, chapter 2, that section that describes the living entity getting release from material bondage, is being expanded on here in this discussion. Lord Kapila Dev to Devahuti. Even going back before that, the vision of Vyas, which is the foundation of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, he wrote the Bhagavatam based upon the vision that he had in trance according to Narada's instruction. So he saw a number of things. It doesn't detail it. He saw Samyak Pranihate Amale in trance. He saw the Lord, he saw the living entity, he saw Maya, he saw living entities, Paropi, although transcendental, Manute Anartam, they think of themselves as a product of material nature and therefore struggle. So he saw the struggle of the living entities, he saw the means of becoming freed from that struggle of the living entities. By the linking process of bhakti, then Vyasa understood most people don't know this, and therefore he compiled Srimad Bhagavatam to explain it. Philosophically summarized in Canto 1, Chapter 2, and expanded upon here, chapters 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, and 32. Very graphically. Eight chapters to expand upon the vision of Vyas. So this long description begins with Devahuti asking one question, an important question: how to become freed from undue attachment, affinity for matter, asat trishna. How do you get out of that? Because we're bound by it. The history or the circumstance is, going back in earlier chapters, Devahuti, daughter of Svayambhuva Manu, by her own selection of husband, she selected Kardama Muni. Marriage was arranged, she was married tens of thousands of years, because it was Satya Yuga, tens of thousands of years. She lived very happily serving her husband. She was attached. We get attached quickly, what to speak of tens of thousands of years, to a very elevated, perfect being. You know, a woman's dream, to be married to an elevated, perfect being for tens of thousands of years. But then, part of his perfection was he demonstrated, setting an example of when there was a son of age, he left. He went back to the forest, leaving, you know, the Vanaprastha stage of life. Devahuti was in the care of her son, and she turned to her son, asking this question. Make it really paraphrased and simple. I know the philosophy. We're not this body. I know the philosophy, but I'm attached. And because of that attachment, my mind is disturbed, my intelligence is bewildered, and all those things that we find in Bhagavad Gita. This is due to your illusory energy. Kapila Deva, I know that you're the personality of Godhead. You're my son, but you're the personality of Godhead. And it's your illusory energy, so you put this whammy on me. Can you take it away? Please? How can I become free from this? Chapter 25 is an answer to that question, and all these other chapters are further elaborations on the answer to that question. Essentially, he's saying, through the medium of devotional service that is made available through association of sadhu. And there's details and details. Who is a sadhu? How to associate with a sadhu? When you associate with a sadhu, what's the effect? And so forth and so on. That's chapter 25, devotional service in the association of sadhus. That's, you know, the short answer. Which is the same as Canto 1, Chapter 2, which is the same as Vyasa's realization. But he's just expanding on it. Chapter 26 is fundamental principles of material nature. How does the whole show work? The material nature side. The end of which, so it's Sankhya philosophy. And then at the end of that, it's very short. It says, and the purpose of all of this is to fix your mind on the side of spirit, ultimately fix your mind upon the super soul, and engage in service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Like, that was really fast. The other was really expanded, then fast. That's 26. 27 and 28 are details of devotional service. And 29 is, if you don't, here's the default position. You have to be attached to something. And if you're not attached to the personality of Godhead, you'll be attached to Maya. And being attached to Maya means engaging in fruitive activities. So here's the anatomy of fruitive activities. Here's the program. Something very similar to what Prahlad tells his classmates that are just 5-6 years old. Anatomy of fruitive activities. Material energy will keep you really busy. There'll be no time for devotional service. Just ask an honest person. I don't have time to come to the temple. I don't have time to chant japa. I'm too busy. I don't have time to read Bhagavad Gita. I'm strapped on to this machine that keeps me really busy. Become entangled in fruitive activities. And then chapter 30 is, you die. And then, you get taken to the hellish planets because you did sinful activities. And then that detailed description is presented. Not very inviting. Pretty scary. And we'll hear Prabhupada in a summary just touch on it's something to be wary of. Like the discussion yesterday evening about Prahlad being not afraid of the fierce features of Lord Nrisimhadeva. He is, in a healthy way, afraid of being in this material atmosphere. It's a very dangerous place. So that's detailed, why it's dangerous. And then, after being taken to the abode of Yamaraj, then some hellish life, and then kind of fast forwards to chapter 31, taking shelter in the womb of a mother in the human form of life again, and details what that experience is like, and then the experience of birth, which may be painful for the mother, but what to speak of for the child, poor child, and we celebrate, oh, happy birthday. And then, you know, what that experience is like in infancy. Read it. It's not, you know, it's not exaggeration. It's just reality. And then, you know, the miseries and miseries and miseries and miseries, and then it goes up till youth, and then it kind of fans out into more, rather than detailing the stages of gestation and the stages of becoming conscious and being bitten and gastric juices and stuff and stuff and pain and crunched over and you can't do anything, you're in an airtight sack and let me out of here. So praying to the Supreme Lord, let me out of here, I'll be your servant. And he comes out and he forgets. You know, so, and then the nature of distraction from the purpose of life. And then now comes the conclusion. So that's the how we get to this. The advocacy of Kapiladeva to Devahuti is the same as what he said in chapter 25. It's devotional service in the association of sadhus. That's Devahuti, that's what to do. To get out of the entanglement and forgetfulness, fruit of activities, attachment, bewilderment, and then repeat. And repeat endlessly. It's a machine that doesn't stop until it gets withdrawn by the personality of Godhead. It's the time machine, it just keeps going. By design. Unless one takes this channel by good fortune, sadhu sangha, say yes instead of no, and follow that procedure of cultivation of bhakti, not just behaviors, but cultivation of bhakti. All kinds of other things, the time energy and how it works and how time acts upon a conditioned soul differently than one who's on the path of devotional service. Time acts differently. We hear it in Canto 2. It's more detailed here. It's really fascinating. If you ever wanted to be Lord Brahma, this is a great section to read. It tells you at least, you know, some of the PhD technology of how the machine works. The push and the pull and the cause and the effect and how the machine keeps running. At least, you know, undergraduate level study of that. I'm going to read the last two verses, but the verse before the last, he's part of Sankhya. He touches on Sankhya again, which is there's Prakriti, there's material nature, there's the living entity, and then the living entity is endowed with power, the power of sight, but you require an eye. Power of sight is inadequate without the instrument. The instrument is inadequate without the power of sight. And both of them are inadequate without the soul animating both. The soul is inadequate without being connected with the personality of Godhead. It's like that's where Sankhya is headed. If it's not atheistic Sankhya, if it's theistic Sankhya, that's where it's headed. Connecting the individual soul to the Supreme Soul. Knowing the distinction between the soul and the Supreme Soul, the distinction between the soul and the power of the senses and the instruments of the senses in the field that the senses are engaged with. Yep. Proper discrimination. When the light's on, all of that's clear. Unfortunately, conditioned souls, the light's not on. It's darkness. And through false ego, we identify the self with the covering, with Prakriti, which is exactly what Vyasa saw in his realization. And then the means of extrication is also being described. Okay, so that brings us to the last two verses of chapter 31. Therefore, text 47, one should not view death with horror, because it's been described, nor have recourse to defining the body as soul. That's the do not, and then there's the do. Nor give way to exaggeration in enjoying the bodily necessities of life. There's necessities, but not undue involvement in the necessities of life. This Bhagavatam, this statement, it resonates perfectly with Rupa Goswami's teachings, or the other way around. Rupa Goswami's teachings perfectly resonate with the teachings of the Bhagavatam, because Lord Chaitanya's teachings are the Bhagavatam's teachings. The Bhagavatam teachings are Lord Chaitanya's teachings. So Rupa Goswami, in this description of renunciation, it's a big topic for people who are spiritually inclined. How to live in the world but not be of the world. In the world but not of the world. And it comes up in the purport that we're going to read for the last verse. How are you supposed to be Krishna conscious while performing your duties? Whether it's school, work, home, social, civic, etc., dealing with your body, dealing with relatives, dealing with the energy. How are you supposed to be Krishna? Is it practical? Devahuti asked the question, directly. Again, when he's describing devotional service and it extricates the soul, she says, basically, wait a minute. I get the philosophy, but is not the soul so inextricably involved in matter that even if you get this bodhi, this spiritual intelligence, and you direct your life in the right way, then we're so involved in matter, next thing you know, you're involved in matter again. Ever notice? No, you get some, this like realization or exhilaration or inspiration, and some time passes and you're kind of bungee cord right back where you were, or close to it at least. Is it really possible, Devahuti asks, to extricate the soul from its involvement in matter, really? And Kapila says, yes, through bhakti, because bhakti severs the connection with matter. It dissolves false ego and the material mind. Svaropena Vyavastati. We're going to hear about that. It's very powerful. You have to use it properly. But the power is there if we use it properly. We'll experience that. Not like lessening the what's the first canto, chapter 2? Krishna Krishna. The process of devotional service diminishes the influence of involvement in matter. What's that? Age has a way of diminishing memory. It's just one of those things that happens.
Is it in the section of Svinvatam?
Huh?
Svinvatam, Sakata Krishna, in that section.
In that section, yeah. But, so... Abhadra. Where bhadras become diminished. Anyway, bhakti has the process initially of diminishing and then eventually of eliminating. No, it's before that. Anyway, sorry. So the verse of Rupa Goswami is, nor give way to exaggeration in enjoying the bodily necessities of life. You know those two verses that deal with vairagya or renunciation? There's palgu vairagya and there's yukta vairagya. There's false renunciation. False renunciation is you give things up that are in relation to Hari. And proper renunciation is anasaktasya vishayan yatarham upayunjitaha nirbandha krishna sambande yuktam vairagya uchate. That verse. So, anasaktasya vishayan, without attachment to sense gratification, vishaya. Anasaktasya vishayan yatarham upayunjitaha. Yatarham is a very curious word. According to suitability. According to suitability. So, for example, according to varna, or according to ashram, let's say, according to ashram, what's suitable for a sannyasi is not suitable for a grahastha. What's suitable for this grahastha may not be suitable for that grahastha. It's, you know, it's customized. In groups, but also in individual, according to each one of us as an individual, that we may feel a certain need for something, a certain amount of comfort or a certain amount of something to eat or a certain amount of climate control or a certain amount of something. And if it's not that, you know, threshold, their mind is not peaceful, we can't really focus. So there's certain quote, needs. They're not needs of the soul, they're needs of our embodied condition. And as Krishna consciousness increases, that sense of need changes or diminishes. It's a sign of advancement, is absorption of the mind in stuff diminishes because there's a happiness within. Higher taste. Pram drishtva nivartate. Vishaya vinivartante. Same vishaya. The looking for happiness in terms of senses, contacting sense objects, to try to just cut it, it's artificial. But by experiencing higher taste, so it's like how Prabhupada introduced Krishna consciousness. Lots of prasadam, lots of kirtan, some philosophy. And his wonderful association. And then his audience was able to give up stuff. Not because he told them, you got to give up stuff and then I can give my association. They asked him, Swamiji, aren't we supposed to be following some regulations? Yes. I'll tell you tomorrow. And that's when the four regulations came. Before that, there was no four regulations. So, diminishing of vishaya, the expectation of happiness through sense gratification arises as bhakti becomes stronger. So what he's being said here is, without giving way to exaggeration in enjoyment of bodily necessities. So, yatarham, according to suitability, one person to another person, or even in one person's life. As I progress, I should wish my life becomes more simple. My needs are going in the direction of my relationship with Krishna and away from I need another cell phone or something. I'm amazed, you know, when I fly, people not only have, it used to be one, then it was two, then it's three. And they're, you know, because I travel southwest, so the people that don't even know each other, they spend the whole flight talking about what's the latest, showing what their gadget can do, and then the new one. Oh, I have to get one of those too. Absorption and distraction. Anyway, nor give way to exaggeration in enjoying the bodily necessities of life. Realizing the true nature of the living entity, one should move about in the world free from attachment and steadfast in purpose. That's a really great summary statement. And there's one more, and then the chapter ends. So all of this is a therefore statement. It's a summary of all of this anatomy of fruitive activities and the consequence of fruitive activities. And fruitive activities being the consequence of not paying attention to bhakti. So therefore pay attention to bhakti, because those two chapters are scary. Pay attention to bhakti. And paying attention to bhakti doesn't mean abnegation. Call the world false, or you must take sannyas, or renounce your worldly possessions, or any of those kind of things. It's according to suitability. You live in the world and cultivate inwardly, you cultivate devotion to the Supreme by exactly as Prahlad was saying to Lord Nrisingadev from those prayers, is hearing in the association of saintly people. Sadhu Sangha Bhajana Kriya Anartha Nivritti. Such a beautiful purport. I'm going to read it. This is going to be a long class because it's a summary. Anyway, a sane person who has understood the philosophy of life and death is very upset about hearing of the horrible, hellish condition of life in the womb of the mother or outside of the mother. That's the prior section of this chapter. A sane man. Oh, but one has to make a solution to the problems of life. A sane man should understand the miserable condition of this material body without being unnecessarily upset. First he said it's natural to be upset. Without being unnecessarily upset, he should find out if there is a remedy. The remedial measures can be understood when one associates with persons who are liberated. Sadhu Sangha. It must be understood who is actually liberated. It's like a lawyer making a case. The liberated person is described in Bhagavad Gita, one who engages in uninterrupted devotional service to the Lord, having surpassed the stringent laws of material nature, is understood to be situated in Brahman. In case you're not familiar, that's the last verse of chapter 14. Chapter 14 is about the modes of nature. And the last verse is how to get beyond the modes of nature. Because Arjuna directly asks, how do you get there? And this is the answer. Mamcha yovya vicharena bhakti yogena. So like that. So saganan samatityaitan brahma boyaya kalpa. When it once it comes to the level of Brahman. That's the liberated person. Find such persons, engage in associating with and hearing from such persons, and that's the path of liberation. Then he goes to the Bhagavatam, where Bhagavatam says the same. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, this next paragraph, is beyond the material creation. It is admitted even by impersonalists like Shankaracharya that Narayana is transcendental to this material creation. As such, when one actually engages in the service of the Lord in various forms, such as gives names, he is understood to be on the platform of liberation. The Bhagavatam also confirms that liberation means to be situated in one's constitutional position. When you're familiar with the Bhagavatam and you read Prabhupada's purports, every sentence, almost, is a restatement of something that's in the Bhagavatam. So that one is hitva muktir hitvanyata rupam svarupena vyavastati. He would quote it again and again. Svarupena vyavastati. Svarupena vyavastati. It's found in Canto 2, Chapter 10, where Shukadev Goswami gives the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam. And one of them is liberation. So it's in that section where he describes what liberation is, which is right here in the purport. What liberation is muktir hitvanyata rupam svarupena yavastati, which means what it says here. You engage in devotional service, and that's the state up to the personality of Godhead. That's liberation. And how do you get it? You associate with sadhus to get it. And you do what sadhus do. Bhajana kriya. Properly directed, with the proper intent, the proper focus of consciousness, not just a behavior, but cultivation of Krishna consciousness in the association. So Kapila Deva has just given 8 chapters to expand that and the consequences if you don't. Since a living entity is eternally the servitor of the Supreme Lord, when one seriously and sincerely engages in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, he is situated in the position of liberation. One should try to associate with a liberated person, and then the problems of life, namely birth and death, can be solved. Not only the question she asked about undue attachment, because when there's undue attachment, then birth and death. So to solve the birth and death, you have to go back to undue attachment. You have to entangle that one. You have to go back to attached to the personality of Godhead through the association of those who are attached to the personality of Godhead. And, you know, properly is being situated like that. Avoiding offenses and so forth. Sincerely and earnestly engaging in those activities. The next paragraph is describing false renunciation and genuine renunciation. Prabhupada makes this very interesting statement. Actually, renunciation is not possible. By that he means this, it's not ours to renounce. Everything belongs to Krishna. Who can renounce something that belongs to somebody else? Rather, it's engaging that which belongs to Krishna in service to Krishna. That's proper. That's what real renunciation. So it's going to come in the next verse, but renunciation is renunciation of misconceptions. And then automatically following the misconception renunciation is renunciation. You're in the world, but not of the world, which is in the, this is the conclusion. A doubt people have, not only in India, a doubt people have is, gee, if I get really serious about spiritual life, then I have to become a monk. I mean, it's a misconception. Some people are suited for being a monk. Some people are suited for being students. Some people are suited for being householders. We have different nature according to suitability. If one is going to take this position, that position, or the other position, same principle holds. Connect with the personality of Godhead. Dedicate all things to the personality of Godhead. Not, you know, not two pockets. So much for me, so much for Krishna. It's the one pocket program. Everything for Krishna. Whatever your position. There's necessities, so you can be peaceful, and you accept those things, knowing well to whom they belong, and you engage them in Krishna's service, according to suitability. So here's the concluding verse and purport. Endowed with right vision, small thing, samyak darshanaya buddhya, endowed with right vision and strengthened by devotional service and a pessimistic attitude toward material identity, we're not optimistic about finding happiness through fruitive activities. Some people, they profess the philosophy, but they're very optimistic. And if it doesn't happen, then they're disappointed. Well, you're setting yourself up for disappointment by engaging in fruitive activities, because it's not an optimistic proposal. It's, we may do what we need to do, but we're not expecting happiness from that. We're expecting happiness rather, because we want happiness, from being in a position of devotion to the personality of Godhead. And there's going to be ups and downs. It's just how it works in the material world. There's duality, sometimes and sometimes. It's really nice weather in Detroit right now. And sometimes it's very harsh weather in Detroit. But there's lots of opportunity for devotional service, and that's why these, some of us stay here. Some think, you know, the economy's going better, so I'll stay here. Anyway, we're not optimistic about identifying ourselves in terms of the body and the objects of the bodies. One should relegate his body to this illusory world through his reason. Thus, one can be unconcerned with this material world. The detachment. For bhakti to be strong, that expectation for happiness has to subside. Otherwise, asat trishna. It's one of the sources of anarthas within the heart, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Harinam Chintamani. You won't be able to chant the holy name effectively as long as there's this hankering for happiness in asat. You have to do what you have to do, but don't expect happiness from that. Expect happiness, just you, there's necessities and you deal with it. It's cold, you get a jacket. It's warm, you get a fan, or whatever you're going to do. When you're thirsty, you get some water. Then have necessities. Without undue obsessiveness about, I got to have more necessities. You know, live simply and find happiness in the relationship with Krishna, offering with love, whatever Krishna has provided you. Anyway, purport. Interesting way to start the purport. It is sometimes misunderstood that if one has to associate with persons engaged in devotional service, he will not be able to solve the economic problem. very interesting. I mean, out of all of this, there's all these miseries, and then some people would say, okay, the solution is association with sadhu. Uh-oh! My material prosperity is going to be pinched. Certainly it's from parents that see their children are going to get involved in the Hare Krishna movement. Especially from India. Right? Strong. You know, you can go to the temple, but don't be a fanatic. You got your career, you know, and so on. You all know this one. Very strong. But it's not only, it's all over. You don't have, by associating with saintly people, doesn't mean the outcome is you become a monk, or you renounce the world, or become a sannyasi, or, you know, your interest in economic welfare. Or even aside from parents, someone else may say, well, gee, if I get too involved in this, I'm going to get distracted from my career plan. But it's quite different. One's capacity to do things improves. One's effectiveness because of clarity and not getting all cluttered with distraction due to attachment. You're very clear and very effective. And the intelligence that comes from the super soul is provided in order to do what's necessary. To answer this argument, it is described here. Interesting answer. One has to associate with liberated persons not directly, comma, physically, comma, but by understanding, comma, through philosophy and logic, the problems of life. Well, yeah, I don't have to go to the ashram and live in the ashram with the sadhu or guru. I don't have to renounce the world and my worldly necessities. I can associate through hearing, properly understanding instructions, living according to those instructions, and then my association will be fulfilled, and the elevation of consciousness will be thereby fulfilled, and I don't have to abandon my career plan. Or the necessities, seeing to the necessities. I don't have to abandon that by taking association with sadhu. The sadhu doesn't demand that. Krishna didn't demand that of Arjuna. Just the opposite, according to suitability. It is stated here, samyak darshanaya buddhya, one has to see perfectly. And by intelligence and yoga practice, one has to renounce this world. Householders remain householders. Renouncing the world means, in this case, without attachment to it, in the world but not of the world. That renunciation can be achieved by the process recommended in the second chapter of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Already described. Final paragraph. The devotee's intelligence is always in touch with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His attitude towards the material existence is one of detachment. So in the translation is pessimistic. Here is detachment. Same idea. You're doing, but you're not attached. You're not hopeful it's going to bring happiness. You're doing because there's necessity. You have to eat, etc. There's necessities. I do because there's necessities. But I'm not expecting happiness to come from that. It's helping to maintain the body in healthy order so I can properly pursue the purpose of life. Because I took the time out to ask, what's the purpose? And I found somebody that could guide me to the purpose. unfortunately, there's lots of people that don't ask, and there's when the people do ask, they get answers from people that don't know. His attitude towards the material existence is one of detachment, for he knows perfectly well that this material world is a creation of the illusory energy. Realizing himself to be part and parcel of the Supreme Soul, the devotee discharges his devotional service and is completely aloof from material action and reaction. Thus, at the end, he gives up this material body or the material energy, and as a pure soul, he enters the kingdom of God. Nice way to end the chapter. You know, this, the movements of living entities from the hellish place, injected into the womb of the mother, and the whole thing, and then the experience of being born, the experience after birth, the bewilderment, and on and on and on. There's a solution. And a serious person wants the solution, and hearing the solution, they cultivate that solution in the association of devotees with this, dealing with the necessities in the mood of detachment. Not finding standard of happiness is getting stuff and then accumulating stuff. Now I'm successful. I have a nice standard of living and everything is nice. And that's silly. And in a moment, it's all gone. In so many different ways, health-wise, or so many, this is a very unstable place. It's not a place of shelter. So that's the 10th topic, is ashraya. And so it's a very wonderful subject discussed by Jiva Goswami in Tattva Sandarbha. What is that? And it's ashraya and swashraya and swashraya ashraya. He's the shelter of those that are giving shelter, etc. The personality of Godhead is where our attention should go while we're fulfilling our necessities and doing our duties of life in this mood of detachment, cultivating attachment to the Supreme with very careful deliberation why we're doing that, and strengthening the spirit of devotion as we're doing that until there's nothing else. Like Mahaprabhu, he carried out his daily duties because there were daily duties, but his consciousness was somewhere else. He still did his daily duties. And we're being trained in that line. Okay. Any discussion? Yes? Yeah.
I've always had a question about the translation of that verse that it says, all that's troublesome in the heart is almost completely destroyed.
That's the verse, Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu. There we go. The answer is, it's describing the stage of sadhana, not the stage of perfection. Progressively, it'll completely destroy in the stage, so it's in the nishtha, it's almost destroyed.
And it will eventually.
Yes, and it will eventually.
By following, yes. Continuing to follow the same.
Yes. Process. It's just describing a stage, the nishtha stage. Nashta, prayeshu, abhadreshu.
So that, then I had another question.
Yeah.
When you're speaking about that point, you mentioned that our connection to material affectation will increase as bhakti increases.
Yeah.
sometimes when people come in, they have a very simplistic lifestyle and they seem very surrendered. And then later on, as they're practicing, they seem to accumulate more material connection and affection. So what's happening?
A number of things. It's possible that they're just practicing improperly. It may also be the unfolding of the reality of their life. That is to say, in youthful idealism, the youthful idealist, let that youthful idealist go down the path of bhakti or not down the path of bhakti. And either way, the unfolding of those yet to be matured material desire will take place. So, it could be a combination of those two things, not properly applying the process of bhakti, combined with there's desires that are yet to have fructified and mature and manifest. So what we need to do is properly apply the process of bhakti. So when those things that are desires arise, let's just say, someone starts as a single man or a single woman, and they're not particularly, rah-rah about having a relationship with someone. They just they have goals and values, and they want to live those goals and values, and then some time passes, and then this other desire becomes prominent. How do you manage that other desire? If you're following the bhakti process properly, it doesn't go over the top. If I'm not engaging in the process of bhakti properly, it eclipses the process of bhakti. Which surely would have happened if there wasn't any bhakti process. It just spill over all over the place. So we should follow the bhakti process carefully and be under guidance of someone that's like described in this purport, but to say matured in the application of the bhakti process in their life and have some capacity to guide others. It's not everybody that can guide others. That's, one of the things that happens in the Hare Krishna movement. Some persons like to teach, but they don't have the capacity to guide. So they start to teach, and then people start to like their teaching, and then they have, they ask for guidance. They don't know how to guide people. It happens. It's like a phenomena. And then and all kinds of other strange entitlement and possessiveness and groupism and people being improperly guided and resentment that they were improperly guided. And there's some discussion, without naming names, of persons that would really like to see a standard be developed, that if you're going to be in a position of guiding others, you get some training. And in that course of training, persons that it's clear they're not so capable, they don't get the certificate. And as we go along, and other organizations do this. We just haven't gotten there yet. That's a structural comment about as we mature as an organization, how to equip our persons that it's going to happen anyway. So we equip them so they're more equipped, and then have some standard. If you're going to lead, you need this training. If you don't, and you're not successful in accomplishing what the training requires of you, you're not authorized. It doesn't stop people from doing unauthorized, but and being authorizing someone doesn't mean they're a perfect person. It just means they have a certain proficiency. Anyway, that's it. That's over answering your question. But it's a concern, an organizational concern, a well-being, a devotee care concern as our movement grows. Yes?
Maharaj was saying about like cultivation, taking up cultivation of bhakti in the behaviors. So as I'm understanding, when I'm learning the behaviors in Krishna consciousness, I should have like clarity of fire and cultivation.
Yes, yes. It's natural. Let's just say, take something, learn to ride a bicycle. When you're learning to ride a bicycle, you're focused on the mechanics of riding the bicycle. But now you've learned how to ride a bicycle. Now how am I supposed to use this thing, this bicycle? So then it depends on what's inside, how you're going to use the bicycle. When we're engaged in the process of bhakti, there's things to do. There's behaviors. The essence is not the behaviors. The behaviors, if done properly, there is conducive to the purpose of the behaviors. So from the get-go, we should be clear in principle, although our attention may go more to the behaviors. Like, let's say, you know, how to perform arti, how many circles with the incense, and things like that. But there's the purpose behind it. So we should be conscious of the purpose behind what we do. Put our hand in our bead bag and say a sound. What's the purpose behind it? What is it that we're intending to cultivate?
When we start learning the behaviors, we may not have the intention.
But if you have a good trainer, at least the seed, the notion is there. So while they're teaching the behaviors, they're mentioning and nurturing and encouraging the consciousness behind the behavior, because that's the essence. And then as you learn the behavior, that seed is now being nourished by that hearing process, and which comes from the association, and that's what's growing as I learn the behavior. Like our discussion yesterday about speaking. It's one thing to learn verses. It's another thing to convey the purpose behind those verses. Just like children can be taught to recite slokas and ask them what the meaning is. They don't know. What to speak of, apply it. I gave this in a class in Italy, and Lakshmi Moni was, here's the behavior. Two things. I said something, then Lakshmi Moni responded. So I said, in 1970, ISKCON Boston, under the instruction of Prabhupada, bought a printing press. And the person that was running the printing press, his name was Advaita, he asked Prabhupada, is it okay to print a Bhagavad Gita that is a pocket edition, doesn't have the purport, just the verses, and people can pull it out of their pocket and memorize a verse and put it back in their pocket. Prabhupada said no. He said, because people won't understand the meaning. Then he went on to say that of the various translations of Bhagavad Gita, the difference is not in so much in the verses, it's in the purport. Without reading the Bhaktivedanta purport, people aren't going to understand the meaning, so no. And Lakshmi Moni said, Prabhupada said the same thing in Dallas about Gurukul. He came from Los Angeles to visit the Gurukul, and the first thing they did is they had the kids stand in front of Prabhupada and recite their Bhagavad Gita verses. Not in front of the kids, but later to the teachers, Prabhupada said, don't do that. Because they don't know the meaning. better they understand the meaning than just recite slokas. I mean, parents like it when kids stand up and recite slokas. And kids are giggling. But, you know, what's important is the meaning. So, the behavior is fine. Be trained to how to properly do things. In the kitchen, on the altar, in the Sangha of Vaishnavas, Vaishnavachar. But there's a purpose behind it. And a good teacher will awaken that purpose behind it. And so to be a good student and eventually become a good teacher of other students, that's an essential part. Although in the beginning the focus goes to how do you keep your balance riding the bicycle? Because otherwise you're going to crash. Anything else? Yes.
The first part, the previous verse, two verses which you read, the first verse, Prabhupada says, instructing the Prabhupada right in the first part, that since the living entity is eternally the servitor of the Supreme Lord, when one seriously and sincerely engages in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, he is situated in the position of liberation. So I was wondering why Srila Prabhupada used two adjectives, seriously and sincerely, or how do I apply these two adjectives?
I don't know. I mean, one of them seems to imply feeling, and the other seems to imply intent. So they're not exactly the same. They're certainly complementary. But with sincerely means with deep feeling. And seriously is, I stay with it. Because intention is very clear. So I stay with it and stay with it and stay with it and stay with it. With feeling. With a real sense of purpose and mission and meaning. It reinforces. In other words, why you put two words, it reinforces it. They're not totally distinct, they're not totally the same either. It reinforces. Makes it stronger. Yeah?
So Maharaj, in the second purport, Prabhupada was talking about having a pessimistic attitude towards the world, perspective happiness.
Yeah.
So that is very common way of preaching to people that we talk about, you know, miseries in the material world. At the same time, Prabhupada is also talking about, you know, to focus on bhakti. So then,
they're not contradictory. They're complementary.
I was wondering, how would you use both of them together?
It's right here. It's explicit right in the verse that focus goes here and it goes less over there. Living entities want happiness. We're part and parcel of the supreme happy. So we want happiness. So where do we look for happiness? We're pessimistic in that direction and we're optimistic in this direction. We're spiritually optimistic and materially pessimistic. Who is the parent of this young boy? Huh? Your son needs a little attention. Is that okay? It's that they're not contradictory, they're simultaneous. Optimistic over here, so there's necessities. I'm pessimistic about finding happiness while I'm taking care of necessities. And I'm optimistic, so attention goes here and that's over there. And the way that I invest attention over here, is this just necessary?
I'm wondering is that when you speak to like people who are like are looking at technology, they say, well, here things are changing, you know, more and more things are happening. But you keep talking about pessimism in material life and then something which we have not experienced. Like, you know, talk about spiritual happiness.
Well, you know, read Srimad Bhagavatam and it's very clear. Keep your eyes open and it's very clear. There's reason to be pessimistic. We do things to maintain health and we eat the right kinds of foods and do the right kinds of this and that. But it's not for the purpose of this is where happiness is to be found. Just, you know, it's necessary. And because it's necessary, we invest some time and attention in that area. Necessary. But as devotees, even when we're doing those things that are necessary, our consciousness is directed towards the optimistic feature. I just, something is coming to mind. I did something that's unusual for me. I stayed in one place for 5 weeks in the month of January. It was at an Ayurvedic clinic. And it was a tune-up. So that was necessity. But I took the opportunity, it was planned, to work on some devotional projects that when I'm running around and moving around, I don't have time to do. So it was fantastic. Yeah, I was very optimistic about that and doing something of necessity over there. But the happiness wasn't, in the devotional side, while doing the necessary. Etc. Yes?
It seems to me that this mood of pessimism, or being pessimistic, could be detrimental to preaching. Wouldn't it be, for the sake of preaching and outreach, wouldn't it be better to have more of a mood of like being indifferent or unenthusiastic? Because
it's the same. The indifference or unenthusiastic is due to, if it's going to lead to Krishna consciousness, it's let's take the example of a vegetarian cooking class. You do a vegetarian cooking class, right? No? You don't do that. Okay. Huh? You have in the past. Supposing you decide to do something like that. You know, the hook is this, health and well-being. And you'll feel better and you'll have clearer thought and so forth. As far as a devotee is concerned, that's not the conclusion. The conclusion is to bring people more into the mode of goodness and more into the considerations of ahimsa and well-being of the body for the purpose of cultivation of Krishna consciousness. So we're not optimistic about this in and of itself is that going to increase the quality and value of someone. We're interested in, it will, but that's not the intent. The intent is, through association, to give some opportunity for persons to hear transcendental message so they can understand they should offer their food to Krishna, and etc. You know, take shelter of a lifestyle of devotion to Krishna. To whatever degree somebody can do that. And if they can't do that, then they're a little bit closer to doing that, at least, by the association of devotees. So that's where we're optimistic. And neutral is essentially the same as pessimism. It's just another way of saying it, as far as I'm concerned anyways. It's the, you know, it's the expectation for happiness picture. You can be neutral, or as far as outreach is concerned, we, as practicing devotees doing outreach, we're not expecting happiness from promise of material prosperity or something, or wellness for wellness' sake. Here's an example. This came from Vijay, the book distribution minister, global. You know who that person is? You know Vaisheshika. So Vaisheshika does, that service he does for North America, Vijay does for the world. So Vijay was visiting in Russia, and what he does in audiences sometimes, kind of like an icebreaker, is he asks people how they came to Krishna consciousness, expecting that many people will say, well, I got a book. Then he could say, rah, rah, book distribution. So he was visiting in a, you know, a large area of Russia, and everyone said they came to Krishna consciousness through association with this particular devotee. And then this particular devotee is a medical practitioner. So they came to this devotee for wellness. And they got wellness plus Krishna. So his interest, of course, is wellness. He's good at it. He's gifted at it. He's inspired by it. But his the pessimism is, or the neutrality in terms of outreach is, that in and of itself, this isn't adequate. It'll help people. But really what I want to do is, through that medium of being the wellness guide in their life, give them Krishna, and he's gifted at giving Krishna. So we're optimistic on this side, and from your terminology, neutral is fine. And pessimistic is also fine. It's specifically, again, not expecting happiness to come from that. Wellness, yes, but then we know very well it's temporary and illusory. And so I'm not so optimistic about it. I'll say one more thing. There was a period of time when my health was really crummy. I thought the light was going to go out. So I was searching for some remedy. And I didn't like allopathy, so I went the Ayurvedic direction. I heard about a number of Ayurvedic doctors, went to visit a bunch of them, found one that I really liked. I felt confidence in this person. And his practice was growing and growing, and somebody really liked what he was doing, so they gave him a bunch of money to build the clinic. So he took me through the clinic because he wanted, you know, a little marketing from his side, a little bragging too. So, you know, we went through the top floor and down, 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 down. We got to the bottom floor. It's where he trains his staff. So he said, you know, with all of this, they're at the end of the whole tour. At the end of all of this, I feel confident with the training that I got from my Ayurvedic guru that I can bring wellness into people's lives, but the pessimism. But if they continue the same lifestyle, they'll be in the same illness or lack of wellness again. So what's really needed is not just bringing wellness, but a change of lifestyle. I can't do that, but you can do that. So could you come and train our staff so they can train our you know, the people of how to have a lifestyle change, not just get well. Which is similar to this practicing physician in Russia, some part of Russia, that's what he does. So this pessimism from this Ayurvedic doctor, not that I can't, anyway, get the idea. What's our goal? How do you bring balance into life? It's got to be Krishna-centered. That's where the optimism goes. And the other, say neutral or say pessimistic. It's insufficient. If you like the neutral language, that's fine. And I'll just add, but don't expect by that that the cure of the soul is going to happen. That's the pessimism part. Is that neutral? Something else? Okay. Srila Prabhupada.